Welcome to the Signals Podcast, a monthly transmission of future frameworks for cross-cultural design. I am your host, Elijah Vargas. To build a more inclusive, accessible, and global digital future, we need new frameworks for technological development. Every month, Signals broadcasts insights from visionaries at the forefront of creative inquiry and design innovation about how emerging technology can support cross-cultural connection. What do cultural production and co-creation look like today? What about in 2050? What does cultural exchange mean in the digital age? How do technocultures contribute to or corrode a shared global cultural exchange? How can the nascent technological domains of artificial intelligence, extended reality, big data, and Web3 contribute positively to the planet? Can technocultural exchange tackle the pressing crises of climate change, xenophobia, assault on women's rights, and the crisis of imagination facing the world today? From the San Francisco Bay Area and beyond, these are some of the questions we will tackle. The initiative Sea Change is implemented by the Goethe Institute San Francisco in cooperation with Gray Area and funded by the Foreign Office of the Federal Republic of Germany. My guest today is Cheyenne Concepcion. Cheyenne Concepcion is a Filipino-American artist and designer whose work explores how architecture, politics, history, and aesthetics shape place across a wide range of media, including sculpture, design, social practice, and public art. She is founder of the New Monuments Task Force, a fantastical municipal agency engaged in the dialogue, design, and development of Bay Area monuments and memorials. Thanks so much for joining me on the Signals Podcast, Cheyenne. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here with you and participate today.
Thanks. So what is the New Monument Task Force? And can you also explain what the importance of monument making is to you?
Sure. So the New Monuments Task Force is a fantastical organization that I founded in 2020, actually. And their mission is around reimagining, recontextualizing, and redesigning monuments of the future, beginning in the Bay Area and kind of extending out throughout California. This organization kind of started as a response to a tumultuous summer for monuments in San Francisco, and it's kind of unfolded and produced many spin-off projects through this organization, and which I'm excited to talk about. And they're all centered around participatory public art, recontextualizing monuments in the context of today, reckoning with lost histories, and also creating space for what a new kind of wave of monuments can look like. And why that's important to me is because my practice has been focused on public space and public art. I'm actually a self-taught artist, and my trajectory into the art world was through public space and design. I find monuments to be fascinating artifacts because they kind of store a lot of narrative from the past within them. And I find them to be really interesting entry points to kind of assess where we are today, where we have been in the past. And I've used them as artifacts to kind of inspire many more speculative and experimental projects. And they're usually kind of starting points that have a historical and kind of old context that I'm trying to build from.
There's so much to that moment of 2020, the kind of absurd yet deadly serious response to monuments that has taken place over the last couple of years in the Bay Area, but also around the country in general. I want to ask you a question about monuments in place, because I know also place is such an important part of your practice, separate from monuments themselves. But before I do that, it kind of just occurred to me that this moment, 2020, is like such a charged moment to be starting a project like that. If mm-hmm. even because like the relationship to public space at that time shifted dramatically due to COVID. And so maybe could you talk about the like it coming into existence around that moment?
Right. To go back into the summer of 2020 when this project was originating, it actually, in a full circle moment, started with a connection to the Goethe Institute and an organization called Monument Lab, where I was a fellow and an artist participating in a program called Shaping the Past. It was international, city-based, working with the Goethe Institute across the world. In the summer of 2020, it was a really tumultuous time for monuments and in San Francisco at the time that I was working with the Goethe Institute on Shaping the Past. During this time, not only was there a national conversation and dialogue about the murder of George Floyd and the countless treatment of Black and brown bodies, even dating much longer before that, it was kind of a tipping point for race and reckoning nationally in America. That dialogue filtered down to San Francisco, where the attention turned to our public spaces and our public artworks, specifically monuments. And around San Francisco, numerous monuments were being toppled around the city in the summer of 2020. And there was also a huge political debacle brewing around that same time, around a Maya Angelou monument and the city's mishandling of the building of and commissioning of that monument. And there was also acts by local government where they were kind of going against that movement, where they were removing monuments to controversial figures in the middle of the night when people wanted to gather around these art objects to kind of begin their healing processes. So it kind of turned into this rude debacle of politics, of a national pressures, a community that was questioning their governing bodies, and then these like really historic art objects that no one really felt a connection to. So being an artist in that moment, because my work is so reflective of place, I often look around to the environment that I'm in to kind of draw inspiration and kind of find the next step forward. I find my art making process is very iterative in that way. I was kind of experiencing this really pivotal moment in my city, in San Francisco at the time. And so I decided to kind of use the platform that I had through the Goethe Institute and Monument Lab to create it's more of a social practice work, a project that kind of highlights those inequities, but also provides like a counterpoint that was kind of bottoms up versus this kind of top-down narrative we were getting about monuments. And so after that summer, I think the community was so unhappy and so, and we're very much questioning the governing bodies, the city and the Arts Commission, that the mayor kind of had to step in and try to address the problem with the community and say that they were going to produce a municipal report that was going to solve this issue. And it was going to kind of assess San Francisco's art collection, their civic art collection in relationship to racism and kind of the national dialogue around reckoning at that time. Being an artist, coming from a place of critical reflection, critical critique, I kind of wanted to insert myself into that process because there had been a series of mishappenings prior. And it was also a reflection of that moment, I think. It was a reflection of the kind of taking power back into your own hands. It was a zeitgeist of the moment, of the movement. And so I decided to establish the new Monuments Task Force and hijack that report and produce a better unofficial municipal report. And then through New Monuments Task Force, I established a lot of processes that I think could be replicated in different cities, especially in terms of research and organizing. And that project has kind of evolved because I think now, 2 years later, I've kind of been reckoning with how to grow the project in a place from being an act of retaliation to a kind of like a potent source for creativity, for world building, for future making, for, you know, more of a resource than a retaliation.
I really like that strategic thinking there. I mean, I love it in general when like artists act like nonprofit directors or something like that, because those, generally speaking, those spaces need that kind of conceptual thinking. And it's also really hard.
Right.
But like building a plan, like a strategic plan, is such an interesting question. I mean, the logistics can be an art practice, I think. And that's a very interesting way of proceeding. What you are describing right now is making me kind of think about this relationship of speculative thinking to like civic activism, I suppose. I mean, I really was reflecting in preparing to have this conversation with you. I was reflecting on this idea of challenging top-down monument making that you talk about. I find that very interesting because I probably, like most people, have really no idea what that means. I have this vague sense of how a monument might get erected. I have a vague sense that it's probably a highly bureaucratic process. And I'm aware of the generally like racist and xenophobic world that we live in. Thus, like who gets to be memorialized is itself like never a neutral process. And right. So it struck me as this really wonderful opportunity for you to share with more people, and not for you to share, but like for there to be a conversation around what is the process by which a monument is erected, and what does intervening in that look like in a civic sense?
Right. So I think what was so potent about this project and the speculative nature of it was because we removed the bureaucratic red tape that is involved with monument making and focused on the vision, focused on what things could be versus navigating the bureaucratic policies and then the funding issues and then the nitty gritty of like building a monument within a community. And I think that was what I was worried about with the city in the beginning. I felt like they weren't even addressing the larger question about how they've kind of dropped the ball until then, the processes that it takes in California and in San Francisco, especially for monuments to get built, the funding behind it, the politicians that you need to support the monument that you want to build. And so I think that's kind of the agency artists have really, is to ask the questions that aren't being asked. And that was kind of a primary goal of New Monuments Task Force, that I knew the city wouldn't even, it would completely go over their head, or the Arts Commission would completely go over their head. So the question was, what are the bureaucratic models that come with monument making, right? And for example, with the Maya Angelou monument, a local legislation had to be passed for more women representation in monuments. I think that process started in 2017. So it was like a multi-year process to get there. And when it finally arrived in 2020, they had to fund the work. And there was discussions, and I don't even know if I'm allowed to say this because I got this information from the commissioned artist, but there had been issues with the funder about the final product that was being proposed. And apparently the funder didn't want to support that work. And so I think that it is an example of the bureaucratic kind of models that keep things in place and keep the narratives that repeat themselves and the forms of traditional monuments proliferating, because the funding sources haven't changed, the processes haven't changed, the narratives haven't changed either. I think the fact that, using Maya Angelou as an example, what San Francisco was wanting was a very kind of straightforward narrative of her history with a little quote of her poem. I think what was proposed was a younger image of her with natural hair and like a hand sketch of what Maya Angelou looked like in her younger days before she became who we know her as today, just to kind of honor that younger self of her. And I think that just the fact that it could be totally swiped away by one person in the back room is kind of an example of something that happens time and time again.
And I suppose that the ongoing time frame for which those processes happen are just exorbitantly slow, like slow to the point that they outlast the most reasonable sense of a person who's made, like any kind of grassroots organization, grassroots organizing of making that happen. It's hard to sustain like a cohesive effort of something for like 5 years or something.
That too. And then also politicians, they cycle out. So I think then you lose, you know, the person advocating for you in City Hall. And so, yeah, it's a time thing. Another thing about time is they still haven't produced their report. And that report is going to be a huge issue for getting the Maya Angelou monument built. And so things do take time. Time is definitely not on the city side, but definitely on the artist side. I would say so.
Can you talk about that a little bit more? I'm a little surprised to hear you say that. Not because I have like any knowledge to the contrary, but that's not what I would expect. So why do you feel like time is on the artist's side?
I think that artists and even nonprofit workers, people who don't have to deal with city, who are outside of the institution, of the municipal institution, they're more flexible, they're more agile. They can enlist help in producing a report within 6 months versus 2 years, you know? And so they can go directly to the community. They can and table at a community event. They don't have to get a permit. They don't have to translate. I mean, this is good, but they don't have to go through all the kind of loopholes that you have to do to put on public engagements. If you're not in the city, you can really be on the ground. And I think this goes back to your kind of calling out of the bottoms up approach. You're on the ground in the spaces that people live in. You're not trying to reach them by, you know, a big campaign. You're going up to people and asking them questions. You're emailing them directly. You're calling them directly. And it's a more personable, I would say, down-to-earth approach, and something that is inherent in New Monuments Task Force, which I think is what made it so, it was infectious at the time, because I think it really related to people and it spoke to people as one would speak to each other in a very normal conversation versus using very, you know, political jargon or kind of PR approaches to kind of community engagement.
Yeah, one of the things that this is making me think about is these kind of lower level choices that alternative practices kind of raise, which is, does one try to operate and make interventions within a structure, or does one try to operate via a completely different model and ignore that structure? Or maybe ignore is the strong word, but, and I don't even necessarily want to suggest that those are the only binary options and that we can't think across spectrums and relationality. But in listening to you explain that, I actually kind of caught myself a little bit. I was like, oh, wait, I think I'm actually the one here thinking in a binary about this process. And so maybe you could share a little bit more about this. Like, is the New Monument Task Force is goal to intervene into a governmental process or to create monuments outside of that governmental process?
I think it's inevitable. This relationship to government is at the inception point of New Monuments Task Force, right? It was a critical stance against what the government in our city was kind of feeding us. But since then, I think it's become more of a mission to create space outside the institution. But in that case, I don't even know if we should call it monuments anymore. It's become more of a public art or public memorial because of the kind of format and funding and, you have to work with organizations to get the project done versus, you know, municipalities. And I think the mission is to create space for the future of monuments. I don't think we're there yet. I think we're laying the groundwork for that future moment. And that requires research, that requires having critical conversations in not just San Francisco and, you know, different cities and different arts organizations. That requires engagement politically or community engagement. And it involves testing and prototyping and seeing what other physical forms they could take. So I think since 2020, it started with a research project. It started with the Relic Report. It started with the community-driven unofficial municipal report. It's since spun off into different participatory projects. It's spun off into exhibitions. It's spun off into interventions, public interventions. And I hope in the future that one day we can make a monument, or we can use all this knowledge that we've created, all this momentum that we're building to get there. I don't think we're there yet. But I guess to build off what you're saying, I think we are creating an alternative space outside of that institution, which from the beginning of history has kind of dictated what our public spaces and our public memorials can look like. And so, you know, maybe I'm coming to this realization during this conversation, but maybe it can exist within that structure, within those policies. Maybe the future of monuments has to be outside. And that's also kind of freeing too.
The name, the New Monuments Task Force itself, is such a powerful interjection into any civic process. Like it begs all kinds of questions. Why?
Yeah.
why is the like dominant hegemonic power in place not sufficient for creating representative monuments of the communities who exist in its domain? What new monuments are needed? What is a task force? I mean, the way that you're describing the movement of the project from being about monuments to being about public art is itself interesting in the sense of like what we mean when we describe a monument. Like, is a monument, and I'm sure there's all kinds of art historical, architectural, urban planning kind of theory on this topic that I don't know anything about, but like the question of what is a monument in mm-hmm. that respect becomes very interesting. Like, is it only something that is memorialized by the state? Is that the only thing that actually counts as a monument? Is anything outside of that merely public art or community art? Merely is the wrong word in that sense. Like, there's nothing wrong, of course, with right. public art or community art. Those are very powerful models. But I mean to use that word merely as like an opposition to this verified and validated official entry of public design or sculpture or something. That seems like a very interesting thought to me. I mean, I'm sure you've spent some time thinking about this.
I think you're bringing up a really interesting point and good point, because no, I do think for something to be a monument, it has to be recognized by the powers that be. And I think one of the first things that needs to happen is to expand that notion, because I think we've had to move away from calling something a monument into public art, into a public sculpture, to community-based public work, because none of the things we've done have ever been recognized by the powers that be. And because monuments, that word has such a connotation to it, and an official connotation, a recognized and validated, as you said, connotation, is important to that final step that I hope we're working towards. When you were talking about it, I was kind of thinking about not men on a pedestal, but more like natural monuments, like, you know, the national park system and all the things that are recognized as part of, you know, nature's gifts to America, those are still recognized by the government and still deemed important to go and experience by the government. And so the day that I think that part of it, even though I'm trying to exist outside of this world, this of the institution, the municipal and state institution, maybe there has to be another process for legitimizing a public artwork that isn't fully funded and taken on by a politician and then through that avenue, but maybe starts outside and then towards the end kind of gets that one like signature of approval after you've taken all the steps to design it, build it, contextualize it, get the right people involved, and then maybe they get some kind of like certificate. I don't know. But even though I want public art and work to reflect the people that it's in, I do think the fact that it's being recognized by this country, by this state, by this city is important to also honor the people that are making it or who it's about or the history that it's kind of trying to remember or the special occasion that it's memorializing, things like that. I do think that there is an inherent connection to the city, which I could think the question is, when do they come in and do they have to be there through the whole time? I don't think that's always the best for producing innovative, cool, forward-thinking work, because you don't go to the government to find innovation. You don't. That's not the first place you're looking for, you know?
No, it generally is not. I give credit where it's due. There are certainly, I think I truly believe that there are radical individuals working to transform all entities, whether they are governmental, energetic, earthly, solar, human, animal, mineral, or otherwise, not to discount that, but that general outcome of bureaucracy tends to be one of delay and conservatism and fiscal austerity of some sort. Like 15 years ago, I lived in Budapest in Hungary for a year, longer ago than that now. And something that's interesting about Hungary is the way that it's been occupied as a nation by so many different foreign powers. And one of the outcomes of that is it has this really interesting relationship to its public monuments. Mm-hmm. And so outside of the city of Budapest, there's this museum, I think it's called the Statue Museum or the Monument Museum or something like that. And it's where they took all of the communist sculptures, public sculptures. And it's now like an archival curiosity. Mm-hmm. Where you have to like take a bus to get there, and it's just all this old communist, like Soviet stuff. And I'm just saying this because I'm wondering if you've looked at different places around the world. I mean, this is kind of the dilemma with the United States, right? Is like we so inevitably think that we are smarter and better than everyone else that we ignore all of this other grand histories, even histories that have taken place on this country before it was a country. We ignore all these really ambitious ways that institutions overcame extreme fascism of various sorts. Right. And so I'm wondering if you've looked at any of these moments in time in relation to thinking about design of public spaces and monuments.
So this journey with the Goethe Institute began very much looking at what was happening in Berlin and what the memorial landscape in Berlin after World War II. So that idea has been kind of inherent through my thought process with going through this project. And I love this example you brought up of this graveyard of communist monuments. I haven't been to one, but I've read about others, not in Budapest specifically, but I think it's such an amazing idea. And I think with other countries and their kind of like dark histories and mistakes, that's the thing, it's a mistake. And I think that the US isn't gonna, the first step is to call that out for what it is. And I don't think that's happened or I'm not sure it ever will. But one thing that happened in Berlin was the admission of the mistake and then instituting a plan to try to do something about it. People can argue about how they went about it. My interpretation of that landscape, it was very comprehensive in the same way that when the Nazis took over, their approach to kind of segregating all the different populations and kind of bringing them to concentration camps and identifying people as people that were on the opposition. I feel like with their monument landscape, they almost took the same approach, but in a reverse positive light. Like there was a monument to the LGBTQ community, and there was a monument to the Polish Jews, and then the Romans. And then, so there was this kind of like very organized approach that the Nazis took. And I think on the flip side, there was also a very organized approach to kind of reconciling that situation. I think in America, I think the totalizing and triumphant narrative is so deeply ingrained. And then there's also almost like a fantasy involved, right? We never talk about the dark sides of wars. We don't talk about the wars we lose. We talk about the ones we win. And I think this fantasy we create about ourselves is going to be really hard for us to kind of reconcile with the mistakes that were made. Maybe I'm pessimistic, but I think there's a lot to learn from other countries. And for example, showing them in museums, showing those communist statues in a museum as a learning point of learning, I think is super strong. I would love it if San Francisco could do that with all the fallen monuments. And I've actually thought about this. A lot of monuments end up in Golden Gate Park, because a lot of monuments are gifts from other countries. They're kind of, you know, a park of the city's territory. They can do whatever they want in those places. I think it would not only be an amazing point of learning, it would be a really interesting tourist attraction. And it would be like a really cool outdoor museum if we were honest about that relationship. I think that's an ambitious, something super ambitious to want, but at this point, why not? And I think that's like a 20-year project, but to me is a solution. To me, I feel like that would be a solution that kind of satisfies people who do, you know, have kinship with this general so-and-so that was toppled in 2020. They can go visit that person, and then but you know, it could also be contextualized for folks who have histories of being personally victimized by that war or that general in that war. And so I love that idea. I do hope that places like this can exist where there's spaces of honesty and kind of humility. And though I am pessimistic that America can get their heads around that.
One of the recent guests on the show is queer game designer A.M. Dark, whose work is also about game design and African-American experience. And one thing that they said is that in the United States, we are so bad at conflict, like discussing conflict and thinking critically about conflict and having any kind of humility or grace while pursuing the resolution to conflict as well. And I think that was very well said.
I think so.
By A.M. Dark, because monuments or public art in general, public space, I think more than monuments, more than public art, public space becomes such a contentious place of ownership and grievances. And a lot of the time the grievances aren't there's like a very outlandish relationship between what the grievance is and what the expectation is. And generally the people who are most deserving of those grievances just get completely ignored. I wanted to ask you about, beyond the New Monuments Task Force, though encompassing of it, is if you could talk about how the built environment in general can foster a kind of cross-cultural exchange or experience for people. I mean, because we're kind of hovering around this in these different models that we've been exploring. But I'd love to hear about that in relation to your practice writ large, but also just your ideas on the role of the built environment in doing that.
I do use the built environment as inspiration. I feel like it inspires my installations physically, but what I'm trying to do is create collaborative spaces. I think with New Monuments Task Force, I did that in a COVID environment, so digitally. With recent installations, I feel like I've created physical space for connection. And that's on a small scale. I think the built environment could be a global scale, but I think what I've taken on is more of a small, intimate community scale in a lot of my works. I think that when you look to the built environment, I think you kind of realize how much you actually have in common with other people. And when you can kind of draw that out and almost like magnify it, I think it really creates a lot of points for connection between different cultures. In a recent work, I kind of built a traditional architectural installation that was native to the Philippines, but located in the bayous of Louisiana. So this idea of how architecture, culture, physical craft kind of can migrate through different places is a theme that there's millions of examples of that movement, you know? And I think that distilling that down, it really makes it easy to understand how similar we are to each other, even though we speak different languages, look different, and, you know, maybe our countries are governed different. But I think that because my work is so inspired by the built environment, I've actually seen so much more connection through trying to either design it or research it or photograph it and put it into my more visual works. I think just that kinship can bring together a lot of shared memories that could cross cultures, I think.
Is it right for me to say something like, particularly from the perspective of a designer, the capacities for materials to speak for themselves can be really powerful?
I would say so. I would say clay, I'm not a clay artist, but it has traditions in almost every culture. And that could be a connection point between Asia and Africa, you know, the Middle East and America, or Native American pottery and Asian pottery. So I think materials, they're the original artifacts. What we do with them, I think, and how similar different cultures have manipulated material is just another example of how similar we are, and how kind of borders don't really matter, country citizenship doesn't really matter. And it's actually something I've been trying to kind of reckon with for a while now. There's been a lot of different ways that I've tried artistically to kind of go about that. Something coming to mind right now is a project I did called Borderlands Archive, where I just started collecting materials from different cross-cultural areas where maybe they were segmented by a border. I'm from Southern California, so my intro was San Diego and Tijuana and how similar they are. And I was just starting to collect things like corn. Corn from Mexico is very different from corn from America, but also very much the same. And mud and clay from Tijuana is the same composition of mud and clay from San Diego. So I think materials show us how small the earth actually is.
Yeah, I didn't necessarily mean to make us deviate away from this idea of like the public park that is a graveyard for monuments or something. It just seemed to me that this question of the relationship between the built environment and, like, I guess I feel like modern humans, we moderns, whatever that might mean. I mean, I think of thinking about that a little bit in like the way that Bruno Latour describes what a modern is, but whatever. Humans in the United States alive now who are shaped either positively or negatively, either in an oppressive or in a privileged way through kind of Western discourse of meaning making, are so attuned to only valuing meaning-making as representations, meaning when given the opportunity to have words to describe things, but meaning rarely emerges out of the presence of objects or structures in complex ways. I'm thinking about maybe the role of like a monument in a community that was once maybe full of corn production being a monument of corn, and just the presence of like real corn in that place might be a meaningful memorializing of that space. Mm-hmm. And it need not have more than just the presence of that corn, particularly in its otherwise absence, becomes a very powerful gesture. And I'm just thinking of the ways that that operates in the world and the capacity for exchange. I mean, I love what you're saying about like the similarities yet differences. Do you happen to remember, there is this very hilarious, I don't remember the person who did this, but there's this very hilarious argument for creationism, like the idea that the Christian God created the world, which is that a banana is perfectly fit for the size of a human's hand. And this person goes through this exercise of like peeling down a banana and showing how perfectly it fits and being like, this object was designed for humans by God. And it was very quickly brought to this person's attention that like, there are actually hundreds of different types of bananas. And the banana that you're holding is essentially a monocrop that was developed by big corporations so that it could survive shipping across the country. And all these other many species have essentially disappeared because of globalization.
Right. I don't know who said that, but I have heard of that argument. And it's similar with the corn example, actually, because I think it's the Monsanto corn that has survived because of globalization, but the old Teosinte corn from Mexico and Central America is struggling to survive for that reason. But I don't know why this whole conversation is making me think of when you're talking about a corn monument memorializing the agricultural history of that place. I think there is one example of a monument I can think of that I really loved, and it's not the shape of a lima bean, but in Southern California, there was a agricultural history of lima beans being really popular in Orange County. And so Noguchi, one of my favorite sculptures by him, it's like an ode to the lima bean, and it's just this random monument in a random park. It's a stack of rocks, but there with the sculpture, there's this whole narrative about lima beans. And so I don't know why my mind went there when you were talking about it, but I think that that's one example of that place memory that he's trying to hold on to, even though it's not directly formally a lima bean. But I think those are the kinds of monuments that I find most interesting, because it has no political agenda. It has, you know, it's honoring a crop, and that's it. And I think that those kinds of things also should exist and be proliferated in our public spaces.
Have you heard of the project in New York City called Historia Historia?
No.
It is a group of Filipino Americans.
Okay.
Who do this practice around cooking. And the whole purpose of it is cooking these traditional Filipino dishes as a way of memorializing the, not just food, but the culture, this like a cultural preservation. I mean, that's simple enough, I guess, but it's a conceptual process or practice. And it's interesting for me to think about that in relation to monuments, because like, when you were describing the lima bean sculpture, what I was thinking is that an actual monument? Like based off of the conversation we were having earlier, like again, it's like this moment of like an artistic intervention, kind of like an artist making an archive. Sometimes it's a real archive. Sometimes artists are like an archivist is like, that's not a real archive.
Yeah.
And you know, all manner of debate around the validity of either of those perspectives, institutional knowledge practices, et cetera, like being able to define and institutionalize a concept or a practice. But it had me wondering, like, is that an actual monument or is it a public sculpture? And to me, all of a sudden, I'm thinking, like, was it designated a monument by the the civic governance in which it exists? And and whether or not that's like the metric for it being a monument.
Right.
And then very quickly, that had me thinking about this very real shortcoming, I suppose, which is the fact that a monument cannot be a lively practice.
Mm-hmm.
By definition, if it is erected, I mean, you know, a sculpture artist might argue a sculpture is always an ongoing event. It is changing by the weather, by the time of day, its very presence. It is eroded with time. It is the most earthly of all, atmospheric of all practices.
Right.
That's maybe real, but a monument cannot necessarily be an ongoing human or biological being engagement. And that's maybe unfortunate. I don't know.
I think so. I think there's a lot of work to be done around this word monument and this definition of what it can be, and something that came up early with New Monuments Task Force. And we were hoping that the future of monuments could be more dynamic, something more ephemeral. This is a thread that has been a huge component of my work recently, trying to incorporate materials that perform with the environment, engaging the sun, engaging the earth around it, water, if there's water there. And there's a lot of issues with that too, because it goes back to the kind of officialness and longevity of a monument. Some materials last longer, and that has been a huge argument that has proliferated marble and bronze, just the sheer investment. And if I'm going to spend $400,000 on this, it better last for 50 years, you know? And then there's the question of, like, is that going to be the best use of that money to serve that community that this monument is living in? Or can we use it to create something that is maybe a little more conceptual, ephemeral, even like a program for education? Could there be some kind of component that involves the people that live in it, an education component, a process-based component? And that's one of the things that came up when we were just starting our process, is how are we going to redefine this limiting term? It's limiting, this term, but I think it's so meaningful. So we can't just ditch it. I don't want to just move away from it and just leave it in history. I think that we need to update it and bring it with us, but make it work for us. And it'll be a long process.
We're getting close to the end of our time, and I have just a couple more questions for you. I'm trying to hold off on asking you the question that the previous guest asked, because I want to ask you your question first, so that, you know, you don't feel like you are, that the previous question is going to influence your question. But okay. I want to take note of where we're at, because I'm so glad that the question that was asked is being asked to you in light of the conversation that we've had. I think, as I've shared a little bit with you, part of the goal of this podcast, because there's such a breadth of guests that I've been in conversation with, I've had this model of asking a question that gets carried on to the next guest. That is a question that is asked by the previous guest. And I mean, to me, it's really important to have this sort of mixture of people in conversation.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kind of the theme of this podcast a little bit is like technocultures, which seems perhaps like it's escaped this conversation, but I actually don't think it has, in the sense that technoculture is a defining way of being in a world in which, like, an object is brought into our presence via a set of digital infrastructure or something like that. And the way that design practices and public spaces are increasingly influenced by digital surveillance or AI identification, and, you know, et cetera. These are parts of our negotiation of a public space, and of hence like how we want public space to be seen or to be experienced, or what our experience in public space individually we want it to look like. I wanted to ask you, because you were describing this monument that you really liked, I kind of had just as a filler question, like, what are some of your favorite monuments? And also, like, what constitutes a good monument for you? And I kind of love how basic and like ill-formed that question is. Like, the idea of a good monument seems totally silly to me. And yet, I'm sure you have some thoughts on like just your own reaction to what are your favorite monuments, but also like what makes a good monument.
Yeah. I think what I've realized and through New Monuments Task Force and, you know, building off of that is I'm really looking towards the future. And so the things I gravitate towards are people trying new things, either materially or through narrative. I also love when the object has dynamism to it and it's maybe either engages people. I've been thinking about, because you mentioned the last artist that was on this podcast was into games and game theory. I had recently come across an artist who kind of designs physical board games as like public monuments to get people involved. So I love this like interactive piece. I think I would love to move away from monuments that are just solely form-based, but more initiate a process with community. And so I think public art that I really love has a process either in building it or once it's built, there's some kind of like iterative process. It grows over time. And materially, I've been really interested in this other artist, Janet Eshelman. I really love her public works. She uses light and textile. And I find that to be such a simple, beautiful expression that is huge and monumental, but also engages the environment. I love this idea of ephemerality. So when I'm looking towards good monuments, I'm looking towards the future. I'm looking towards monuments that engage people, that are trying new things, that are kind of shifting this definition, this limiting definition of monument. And I think we're still early in it. I can't wait for 10 years down the line to see what people are trying to do. I think this problem is surfaced in 2020, and now is the time to kind of figure out what's next. And so I'm excited about that. And so I think new monuments look to the future. They try new things. They include other people.
I'm so glad I asked you that question. That's like a pathway of moving away from that limited. That is an optimistic, change-making, kind of world-building way of thinking of monuments. What is your question for another guest on this show?
So my question is still on the topic of, you know, building off my work with cultural memory. And in recent years, I've been focused on, and I mean, even with New Monuments Task Force, I was focused on spotlighting or bringing visibility to narratives and histories that aren't really talked about, because we love this triumphant totalizing narrative with our public objects, I think, here in America. So my question is about hidden experiences. And I want to ask the next participant, artist or otherwise, what hidden experience they've experienced that they would like to talk about more. Because I think talking about those things is so important and such a learning point for the future, for future audiences, for future artists, creators, you know, nonprofit workers, anyone to learn from. So what is hidden that you would like to share that should be talked about more, either from your own experience, from your culture, or otherwise?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. And I like the cross-disciplinary, cross-practice potential of that question. Thank you. I love hearing everyone's answers to the questions that each other is asking. And so now I'm really excited to ask you the question that my last guest, A.M. Dark, was a guest a couple times ago. My last guest was Jenny Odell, who's a multidisciplinary artist, educator, and writer.
I love Jenny Odell. So this is so exciting that I feel like I'm in dialogue with her.
So. I'm glad. So the question is, either as a user or as an artist, is there a way to shift the relationship with digital objects so that both you feel more embodied, but the object feels like an object that has its own reality? And the reason why that was an important question for Jenny is, I'm going to read a quote from her.
Right.
"I've been thinking a lot about my household objects and having a very embodied experience of interacting with them, but they also feel very embodied to me. I'm interested in how to manipulate that relationship with digital objects. Even right now, you are on my laptop," you meaning me, "you are on my laptop. You are on a really old laptop, I should say, and it's on a laptop stand so it can be the right height for me. And this whole time that we've been talking, I haven't been looking at my laptop. I mean, of course, I'm looking at my laptop, but it's more like I'm looking through my laptop." Mm-hmm. So I'll ask you this, the question that she asked again, either as a user or as an artist, is there a way to shift that relationship with digital objects so that both you feel more embodied, but the object feels like an object that has its own reality?
So instead of looking through a computer, I'm more having a closer relationship with you?
I think the question is kind of like, digital space loses its objectness, and yet it's a fundamental part of how life is expressed, how humans create identities and relationships to place and things and each other. And we have no problem recognizing that or imbuing objects with meaning when they're physical, like, you know, my coffee cup here.
Yeah.
It's a benign object, but I have some kind of relationship to it. And yet with digital space that occupies so much of our time, that intimate, distinct, and unique relationship that is so much a part of what makes life distinct loses its specificity. Mm-hmm. And perhaps we lose something really meaningful as a result of that in our relating with each other. And so how to shift that relationship? I think that's kind of what her question is.
For me, that's a hard question. I think that what would make the experience, I'm a tactile person, so the fact that digital space is only really engaging my visual, auditory senses is what limits it from moving me into the next realm. But I think one way, because I'm so spatial, and I think as a designer, the closest thing that I think could get me there would be creating a dimension that feels physical. So I do a lot of work using 3D rendering programs and like design programs like Rhino and AutoCAD and stuff. So like connecting spatially and creating a more spatial environment, I think would push me over into having that more tactile relationship that I need, which kind of makes me think about VR in a way. And that being probably the next step, even though I'm not an expert on VR by any means, but I think that spatial occupation would be the next step for me, which also makes me think about one of her works that I really liked is when she took a trip on Google Earth. She did a road trip on Google Earth or something. So I think that connected with me because it had that spatial, physical like aspect that someone who thinks very spatially and looks to the built environment for inspiration really connected with me. So I think a more spatial layer could help us connect.
Yeah, it's such a challenging kind of question. I mean, I sort of share with you this inherent dilemma of there being preconditions for the ways in which any kind of digital sensation takes place.
Right.
And so part of my feeling is like, well, sort of like you say, well, then clearly we just need more like touch reactive surfaces and multi-spatial audio systems and non-flat screen-based visual planes. Mm-hmm. And yet that seems to kind of stay within the paradigm or the ontology of a digital physical binary that is, like, I think part of the dilemma of what she's trying to be like, how do we get rid of that digital physical binary? And it's a hard one. I guess it's why, like, you know, in the mid 1800s, when the science of thermodynamics became a thing, it's like, that was hard. And like the steam engine, despite the fact that that feels like old technology to us, that was hard. It was hard to create the kind of metaphysical or epistemic breaks, or the like onto-epistemological breaks that would allow us for thinking new thoughts. Like, what a magical thing to think a new thought. That seems like the thing to strive for. To think that which has not been thought is hard.
Right. But we're trying.
Yes, you're trying very well, and you're helping me make new thoughts about monuments. So I'm really grateful to you for that. Thanks, Cheyenne. Thanks.
It was so nice talking to you.
Yeah, this has been a really wonderful conversation, and I have thought a lot about monuments in new ways during this. So I hope everyone else has as well. It's been educational and quite an inquiry for me. So thank you for taking this time.
Thank you. I'll see you soon.
Yeah, we'll stay here for just a moment, please.
Okay.
To everyone who is listening, check out the New Monuments Task Force at newmonumentstaskforce.org. And you can also look at other work by Cheyenne at cheyenneconcepcion.com. My name is Eli Vargas. Signals is a monthly podcast released with the Signals Digital Magazine at seachange.xyz/signals. The initiative Sea Change is implemented by the Goethe Institute, San Francisco, in cooperation with Gray Area and funded by the Foreign Office of the Federal Republic of Germany. Thanks, everyone. Until next time.